And then we schedule free introductory lessons 6 days a week, every day except for Saturday.
And what are your typical hours? I mean, Nikki and Hillary need some downtime at some point, right?
For lessons, Monday through Friday, we teach lessons from private lessons from 2 to 4:30 and then do groups from 5 to 8.
All right, so there's a different budget possibilities here, right?
Yes,
so you could get involved in a group lesson first to see if your daughter or son are really enthralled with this or just going through the motions.
Yeah, so most people start with a free introductory lesson, and to schedule that, you just need to call the barn. You don't need any special equipment. You don't need any of that. It's a one-on-one lesson with you and an instructor. And then for our young riders, we start with tiny tot lessons. Mm-hmm. They're $270 for a semester of 6. And those are, one-on-one. They're 20 minutes of riding and 10 minutes of brushing and grooming.
Okay.
And then we offer private lessons. Those are half an hour of riding. They're $420 for a semester of 6. Usually, most adults like those. Mm-hmm. And, people who are getting a little more serious. And then we offer group lessons. They're $330 for a semester of 6. And it's 45 minutes of riding and then 15 minutes of caring for your horse afterwards.
Neat. Yeah. Oh, so, and pretty much anybody can come, right?
Anybody can come. We do from 3 up, any experience level, mm-hmm. and we do riding lessons and driving lessons.
Okay, and I've heard getting involved in horses has also got a therapeutic value to it, and I know there are some places that specialize in that heavily, but do you guys dabble in that at all, or is it?
We do. When I was in high school, I did all of my service hours with a therapeutic riding facility, so it's something that's really important to me. I actually chair the therapeutic class committee for our brood organization, so it is something that's really important to me. And we do. We have quite a few riders right now who started off as riding in a therapeutic capacity and now ride, pretty regularly, and a couple of them even compete on a local level. And yes, we do. It's a case-by-case situation. Obviously, we're not a certified therapeutic riding facility. So the most extreme therapeutic situations we usually can't handle, but kind of your borderline, we definitely do.
All right. I think we've covered everything. Let's give out some contact information, websites. How do people find out more about Kirsten and Hillary and Nikki in the barn?
So our website is www.horsecrazy123.com, and all of our information is on there. There's contact forms and everything. Our email is kirstenfarm@me.com,
mm-hmm.
and then our phone number is 908-528-3307. Our secretary, Amy, is there Monday through Friday, starting at 9 a.m. to answer everybody's questions, mm-hmm. and when we're there the rest of the time.
Neat. Great. It's such a great story, Hillary, and you and Nikki in going in this endeavor as past friends from Missouri, you were telling me off air. So good luck with it, and keep up the great work in growing your business.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming. So we learned from Hillary about Farrier's Week. It's been my pleasure to be with you, as I am every weekday morning, 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Vincent Arlenos has never said I should have, perhaps you've had that yearning to get on a horse from one time or another. Maybe you came in from Manhattan and never been on a horse before. Why don't you give Kirsten Farm a call and find out what it's all about. We'll be back again tomorrow. Stay tuned for Chamber in Action with President Chris Phelan and all about the Chamber activities. We'll talk to you again. Thanks for listening to Good Morning Hunter and on HuntChamberRadio.com, the voice of business.
USA Radio News.
We said they spoke once by the phone for a few minutes, but it wasn't about the book. They had a very short conversation, but he never interviewed the president about the book. He repeatedly begged to speak with the president and was denied access, and he makes it sound like he was sitting outside the Oval Office every single day, which is just
the
not the case.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical.
USA Radio News.
We said they spoke once by the phone for a few minutes, but it wasn't about the book. They had a very short conversation, but he never interviewed the president about the book. He repeatedly begged to speak with the president and was denied access, and he makes it sound like he was sitting outside the Oval Office every single day, which is just not the case.
White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders there, as author Michael Wolff is now coming out and saying in his new book, Fire and Fury, there may be parts of the book that weren't all accurate. Wolf was making the media rounds today, and he says some of his sources were definitely lying to him, while others offered accounts that flatly contradicted those of others. Bundle up if you're on the East Coast. The National Weather Service is predicting bitterly cold temperatures and dangerous wind chills for the next few days. Officials fear that the temperatures could drop to as low as minus 20 in some areas. Close to 3,000 planes have been delayed due to the weather. This is USA Radio News.
Everyone loves liberty. Our rights come from God, not from government. So why are you letting other people tell you what's best for your health care? Exercise your freedom with Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of people who voluntarily share one another's medical costs. Liberty believes people should make decisions for themselves and for their families. Members are able to take back the freedom to make their own decisions about their health care. Freedom from guilt or doubt about how your money is used. You have the freedom to direct your health care, not to be dictated to by bureaucrats. Stop letting others tell you what to do and join a community of like-minded people. Exercise your freedom. Join Liberty HealthShare and take back the control of your health care while helping those around you. Call us at 855-58-LIBERTY for more information or check us out online at libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org.
Two leading members of the conservative House Freedom Caucus called for Attorney General Jeff Sessions to resign. Congressman Mark Meadows and Congressman Jim Jordan published an op-ed in the Washington Examiner. Jordan explained some of the unanswered questions he has regarding Attorney General Sessions.
Did the FBI pay Christopher Steele? Were you paying? Were the taxpayers paying Christopher Steele, reimbursing Christopher Steele at the same time the Democrat National Committee and the Clinton campaign were paying him for this dossier? That's a fundamental question, and he would not answer that.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics report an increase of more than 148,000 jobs during the month of December. USA Radio Network's John Clemens reports.
Employment gains were announced in healthcare, in construction, and in manufacturing. In the healthcare sector, employment continued to trend up with 31,000 new jobs. Construction added 30,000 jobs during December, while manufacturing added 25,000 jobs. The nation's jobless rate remained steady at 4.1% for the third consecutive month.
This is USA Radio News.
Meet the coolest ammo manufacturer in America. Even their name is unique. Bite the Bullet. Bite the Bullet offers the highest quality and lowest prices in the country. Buy online, ship right to your door, and always made in the USA. Right now, Bite the Bullet will include 15 extra rounds on any order of 500 rounds or more. This is in addition to their everyday lowest prices. Just use promo code WAR. Order 500 rounds today and get 15 extra rounds free. Just go to bitethebullet.co and use the promo code WAR.
U.S. and Canadian health officials are investigating whether contaminated romaine lettuce caused dozens of E. coli infections, leading to one death. USA Radio Network's Wendy King has the details.
The Public Health Agency of Canada said it found enough evidence to link 41 cases of E. coli to the vegetable, though the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention said it is still attempting to determine the cause. Canadian health officials said they continue to receive reports of illness linked to romaine lettuce and that contaminated product may still be on the market. They advised Canadians to stop eating all romaine lettuce until it can be determined what farm the food came from. For USA Radio News, I'm Wendy King.
As we head into the first weekend of the new year, many of us have resolved to either slim down, tone up, or just become an all-around better person. Danica Patrick has a new book out titled Pretty Intense, a 90-Day Mind, Body, and Food Plan
that will absolutely change your life. She talked about what she hoped to accomplish by writing this book.
What I hope that people take away from it, because the book not only has the workout program in it that's 12 weeks and 50 recipes that I wrote and photographed, which was new for me, but it also has the first part of the book is 5 chapters on the mind. And so what I'm hoping is that people really realize that this is a lifestyle, and I want them to develop a good relationship with food and exercise to not be a reward or punishment, but a way of life and something that makes you feel good and something that makes you a better you every single day.
For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com, and I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hutton Chamber Radio, entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
Well, good afternoon. Wow, first Friday in January. January 5th, 2018. Hard to believe. We've not been on the radio for the last couple of weeks, and so we're back. And guess we want to talk about the sunny, balmy weather. I guess here in Hunterdon County, we really missed what could have been a really horrendous storm yesterday, but everything was pretty much closed down. And so what's happening now? Well, it's 16 degrees, which is balmy compared to what it might be in certain other parts of the country. And we didn't get the snow that they got in Erie, Pennsylvania, and in some other areas of the country, so we can be actually pleased. But still be careful out there, because one of the things that you're going to find is that the roads are not necessarily dry, and tonight that wet easily is turns to ice, and that black ice is really treacherous. So as far as what's happening, there is a wind chill advisory, and this afternoon there's areas of blowing snow and breezy. Again tonight there will be areas of blowing snow, and that continues tomorrow, about a high of about 12 degrees tomorrow, low of about 2 degrees Fahrenheit tonight, mostly clear by tomorrow night, and then on Sunday it should be mostly sunny and a balmy 18 degrees. So that be careful, however, of that blowing snow, because that, you know, if it really blows up and hits your windshield, it's very difficult to see. But by tomorrow night, it's mostly clear, low of around minus 5 degrees, however it could be. And the wind chill value is as low as minus 13 degrees. So just bundle up, put something on your head, and it's not so bad. And those of you who have cars that heat up before you get in them, lucky you. So what's happening, and we're talking about what's happening in the law, and I'll be back after just a couple spots and let you know what's been happening, although not as much as usual in the law, but we'll bring you up to date.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR-DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Well, good afternoon, Friday, January 5th. I'm Pat Smits. The program, It's the Law. And excuse me if I'm coughing, but I'm still getting over what was not a pleasant couple weeks. And we have not been in because of the holidays. So I'm here to just talk about what's been going on in some of the legal issues. One of the issues before the New Jersey Supreme Court, and the lawyers squared off on Wednesday over whether a policyholder should be allowed to pursue a claim against his uninsured motorist carrier, even though his lawyer failed to give proper notice to the carrier that there was a separate claim pending against the at-fault driver. So, you know, these are important issues to insurance companies and ultimately important issues to those of us who have insurance. And one of the things that is so important is to, you know, take a good look at your coverage, because a lot of people think they have coverage that they really don't have. So the courts did limit the scope of the New Jersey Open Records Law in a request over an employee's resignation. Now, this is the appellate division. They ruled that the Open Public Records Act does not require a public agency to provide a detailed disclosure of the reasons for an employee's resignation. And so interesting. I guess you can't always get everything that you wanted in the way of the public record. So obviously, it's probably an issue of whether or not somebody was coerced into resigning. So what else is happening? There was, this is not a published case, but it was a family law case where it was challenging an order denying an application to modify a custody order that the court recently affirmed. And then soon after the court's decision, the appellant again moved in the trial court for a modification of the custody order. And then following the party's arguments and testimony, as well as testimony of a representative from the DCPMP, that's the Division of Child Protection and Permanency, the trial court found no substance to appellate's claim that the custody order should be altered, modified, or amended. And then there was another appeal, and the appellant at that point argued that the motion judge, along with the judge who previously presided over the matter, erred in the denial of her application. So the appellate court affirmed, holding the appellant failed to demonstrate that the circumstances which formed the basis for the existing order had changed in a material way such that modification of the order was in the child's best interests. That the, in this case, then, the court observed that the trial judge correctly applied such principles and found that any arguable changed circumstances were immaterial and of insufficient substance to warrant a modification of the custody order. So therefore, this was affirmed by the appellate division. Not surprisingly, it was not a case that was published, and that's because most of the appellate cases, unless there's something really specific, trial court and appellate court cases are not published, meaning that it can't be used for precedent. But it's still important to read and important to use for arguments in front of trial judges. Now, apparently, the Superior Court judge has refused to halt the sale of a $250 million in bonds that are earmarked for a controversial state office construction project in Trenton, so that these bonds have not been halted. And I don't really know much more about it than that. I do know that there was someone injured in Middlesex County in a two-vehicle crash, and he agreed to a $1.175 million settlement. I know people say, oh, we have such high settlements in New Jersey. On the other hand, you know, most of us wouldn't want to have that kind of an injury. There was a case, creditor and debtor rights case that, in fact, was a Third Circuit, so that's the federal court. And in that case, the plaintiff appealed from a district court, again, a federal district court, granted summary judgment to the defendant. And the plaintiff allegedly incurred substantial debt on a credit card issued by MBNA America Bank. And then MBNA later assigned plaintiff's delinquent account to the defendant, a debt collector. And the debt collector was Portfolio Recovery Association, LLC. Then more than three but less than 6 years after the debt accrued, the defendant filed suit in New Jersey State Court to collect on the account. Now, although New Jersey had a six-year limitation period for collection of debts, the credit agreement with MBNA specifically said that they were applying Delaware law, and Delaware law has a three-year statute of limitations. So plaintiff moved for summary judgment on the grounds that the action was time-barred rather than litigate the issue of whether defendant's tolling statute stopped its limitations period from running against out-of-state defendants. So defendants in this case agreed to stipulate dismissal of the state court action. Plaintiff then filed the present action in federal court alleging the defendant violated the FDCPA and NJCFA by trying to collect a time-barred debt. Defendant moved for summary judgment, arguing that the debt was not time-barred. The district court agreed and granted the defendant's motion for summary judgment in opposition to plaintiff's appeal. Defendant argued that the Delaware tolling statute stopped the running of the limitations period because the plaintiff resided outside of Delaware during the entirety of the credit relationship. So this is the kind of thing that goes on as to whether or not, in this case, whether they could go to federal court, because obviously one side liked New Jersey law and the other side liked Delaware law. And that means each state has a statute of limitations in which you can bring certain types of lawsuits. So anyway, in this case, the Third Circuit reversed the district court's grant of summary judgment, and the court held that the defendant's argument would have the absurd effect of stopping the limitations period from running in perpetuity against customers or consumers who sign contracts with Delaware corporations, thereby denying those consumers the protection of such statutes. So in this case, did not agree with the summary judgment to the defendants. And unless someone gets involved in one of those situations, it's usually not of much interest. Now, there was one of the things that is very important under domestic violence and our prevention of domestic violence statute is there must be a finding of domestic violence. And the appellate court ruled that a trial judge committed an error when she used her equitable powers to enter a restraining order against a man despite finding that his ex-girlfriend failed to prove that he violated the State Prevention of Domestic Violence Act. Very important. There must be a finding, and based on the statutory criteria in order to enter a restraining order, so that a trial court cannot use equitable powers to enter such a restraining order under the Act. Well, the Third Circuit, and as I said, the Third Circuit, I just talked about that, they interpreted Delaware law, preserved the strict time limit for debt collection in New Jersey consumer case. And so that was, even though an attempt by this New Jersey-based debt collector to escape a proposed class action over untimely debt collection. So that's important to always look and see what, in fact, you're signing, because Delaware has a different statute than New Jersey. New Jersey has a very long statute, a six-year statute. So let's there was another, actually a case, criminal law, family law case, that was approved for publication. And they use initials, which they usually do when they want to protect the privacy of parties or children. And the case was MC versus GT, again, appellate division. And there was a complaint against the appellant. And this is, she dated for a while, alleging he harassed her pursuant to the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act. And at the trial's conclusion, this is what I had just said, the trial judge expressed concern about both parties' credibility and ultimately concluded that evidence failed to support a finding of domestic violence. So this is very important. And then the trial judge, however, specifically determined that the respondent failed to prove the appellant acted with a purpose to alarm or annoy. However, the trial judge then evoked what she called her equitable powers and entered a restraining order in respondent's favor. So that was a final restraining order, even though there was no finding of one of the acts that constitute domestic violence. So that's why the appellate court held that the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act does not authorize entry of a final restraining order absent the evidence that appellant committed an act of domestic violence. So then the court noted that the restraints may be permitted based on evidence heard in a failed domestic violence case. So in other words, you can go back if you file another domestic violence complaint, but there has to be an act of domestic violence. Otherwise, it, you know, is just, you can't enter that kind of a restraining order. And it's important because a restraining order is very significant and has significant consequences. Well, let's give you some spots from our sponsors, and then we'll be back with more information on It's the Law.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
This is Tony Clark, para-planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Pat and Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Pat and Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
Hi, we're back. It's Pat Smits. I'm Pat Smits, and talking about some of the cases and things that have been going on from a legal standpoint in the last few weeks. One of the cases, or lots of cases that are starting to be filed, have to do with the antipsychotic drug Abilify. And what's happening is that both the plaintiff and defense attorneys in litigation alleging the use of the popular antipsychotic drug Abilify, the claims are they cause patients to engage in compulsive behavior. And they're now asking, the attorneys are asking for a multi-county litigation designation to ensure that any future cases end up in Bergen County. Apparently, there are now 47 cases in Bergen County. And so that these cases, they want to designate them a class action, that they all are heard by one judge. So that there was a criminal law case that was published, and in that one, the defendant appealed from a denial of a PCR petition following his plea conviction of first-degree aggravated manslaughter. And he, along with Erica Pugh, this is Mr. Beltran, was indicted for murder, theft, and endangering and injured victim. He was offered a plea agreement for first-degree aggravated manslaughter in exchange for a recommendation, meaning a recommended sentence of 12 years incarceration. What happened is he then asserted that he was awoken by Pugh's cries for help as she was involved in an altercation with the victim. And he alleged that when the victim began biting Pugh's hand, he put the victim in a headlock and gave him, to get him to release Pugh, this Erica Pugh. And then he asserted that the victim let go once he began snoring and that the victim died shortly thereafter. So despite the prosecution's concern that the defendant's allocation raised the claim of defense of others. So when he talked about, and when someone pleads guilty, they have to explain what they did and admit their guilt. And so that the prosecutor then was concerned that the defendant, what he said, raised a claim of defense of others. And the trial court concluded that the defendant had waived the defense, despite defense counsel not having raised the issue with the defendant, and further concluded the defendant's guilty plea was voluntarily entered, and the court said the court was satisfied the elements of aggravated manslaughter applied. So then the trial court imposed the recommended sentence, and then the defendant filed a PCR petition arguing that the trial counsel was ineffective for not discussing defense of others and contending that the guilty plea was insufficient to support his conviction. So the PCR court dismissed the petition, ruling that the trial court was not constitutionally, that the trial counsel was not constitutionally deficient, and that the defendant was not prejudiced since he did not have a meritorious defense. And he did not have a meritorious defense because the use of deadly force was not authorized under the circumstances. On appeal, the court reversed, finding the defendant had not waived defense of others before the trial court. The court found that the defendant had made a colorable claim of defense of others, since the victim's biting of Ms. Pugh's hand could lead to serious bodily injury, justifying the defendant's use of deadly force in defense, in her defense. So in this case, the appeal was, in fact, the conviction was reversed, and he would go back and have the chance of another trial based on his claims. Now, whether he wins is another situation, but that's what he would have the right to do. Now, we have a Supreme Court, for the first time since before newly elected Governor Chris Christie made the... This goes back. I can't believe it. This is something... No, this is fine. I thought it went back a couple years. But in any event, the New Jersey Supreme Court, for the first time since Governor Christie decided not to renominate a justice who was up for tenure, the New Jersey Supreme Court had a full roster of 7 justices for the entire calendar year in 2017. And I won't even go back and talk about that debacle, because it was really really unfortunate. And we lost more than one excellent Supreme Court justice. So what else is happening? Not a lot approved for publication recently. And those are the cases that, of course, are most important, because they set precedent. So apparently, because of the constitutional and other considerations, the obligation to avoid the appearance of impropriety will no longer apply to attorneys. Fortunately, however, it still applies to judges whose actions, even off the bench, must never call into question the judge's character or integrity of the system. But the appearance of impropriety, so that, you know, that's such a wide area that, you know, no longer do attorneys have to worry about jumping through hoops to do that. Now, there was a garbage truck versus a bicycle accident that led to a $2.6 million settlement in Passaic. The city of Clifton agreed to that settlement in a suit by a bicyclist who was struck by a city sanitation truck and blinded in one eye due to complications from surgery. So not only was he hit, but then blinded, but not because of the accident, but because of surgery. So the former CEO of Valeant Pharmaceuticals has been ordered to submit to binding arbitration his dispute with the company over allegedly unpaid stock options. So there's always an issue of whether or not there's going to be binding arbitration in those cases. Most of the time, the companies, if you read any kind of a contract, they talk about binding arbitration. So the allegations of sexual harassment continue to roll, as we know. The federal courts and the news media and Hollywood and almost everywhere else, and certainly in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal. So other industries are waiting what seems to be their turn in the spotlight. And this has been just such a turnaround. I'm not going to comment further, but finally, I think some women are finally able to believe that if they say something, they're going to be believed, and it'll make a difference. certainly firing Mark Matt Lauer was significant, and the fact that we have certain legislators who are resigning as a result of allegations, it's creating interesting, especially when we have a president who, despite the tape and despite his, well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, what he was saying was disgusting, but that seems to be just not a problem with some people. Thank goodness we finally had a pedophile who was not elected. But let me not go into that because you'll see my bias. And, of course, I'm also just appalled that anyone would make allegations if they're not true. And that can be just incredible because once somebody has that type of allegation made against him or her, it doesn't go away. So what else? Not as I said, not a whole lot is not a whole lot of interesting things have been reported lately, as far as cases, anything of general interest. So that now Johnson & Johnson is turning the tide on the talcum powder litigation, and with a big boost from the United States Supreme Court. So that, you know, that has been a huge change for Johnson & Johnson. Now, the they're talking about the people who have served the U.S. Supreme Court clerkships and the what we call the feeder judges effectively helping fill those ranks. And apparently that's a world into itself and is one that is very defined but also has very limited ties to New Jersey. In other words, there are certain judges in the usually the circuit courts, and they make recommendations to the Supreme Court to pick. And, of course, the Supreme Court has the pick of clerks, and they don't pick someone just out of law school. The people they select come from some of the best clerks who are clerking for the usually federal, it could be federal district court judges, but usually it's federal, the circuits. So that would, I think most of us would be somewhat in awe of anyone who's had an opportunity to clerk for one of the Supreme Court justices, meaning the U.S. Supreme Court justices. So the New Jersey State Bar Association, the Minorities and Professions section, is hosting a contest for high school students, and the essay topic centers around the repercussions of the Civil War as evidenced by recent rise and discussion and debate about Confederate monuments and whether or not Confederate monuments should be taken down, whether they should be moved to one location, or whether they should stand as they always have. So apparently there was a $50 million punitive damages award against Lockheed Martin that has now been... this was an employee, a former employee, age discrimination suit, and was a, according to a federal judge, was a miscarriage of justice, and said that there was a new trial ordered. She ordered a new trial on punitive damages. So the state There's a case, State versus Burkard, and this is Supreme Court, and the state appealed from the appellate division's reversal of the defendant's conviction for harassment. So in this case, the defendant and Gerald Halton were correction officers whose relationship became strained after the defendant read comments attributed to Halton's wife that defendant found insulting to his family. Defendant then retaliated by photoshopping lewd comment bubbles over the Halton's wedding photos. I'm sorry, you can't make this up. Which were then distributed to as flyers across the correctional facility where Halton worked. And Halton testified that he never returned to work and felt embarrassed and concerned for his safety and received psychological counseling. He later filed criminal charges against the defendant, and this defendant was Burkard, after he felt the defendant was not properly disciplined by his employer. Now, defendant admitted to creating the flyers but denied distributing them. The municipal court entered a guilty plea against defendant, finding that defendant created and circulated the flyers, which were lewd and obnoxious and seriously annoyed Halton. And then there was a de novo trial that also found the defendant had committed harassment. The appellate division reversed the conviction, ruling that the comment bubbles added by the defendant were constitutionally protected speech. So there you go, constitutionally protected speech, and that the flyers were not directed to Halton, but to other correction officers. And then as a result of that, were not a direct attempt to alarm or annoy Halton. So on appeal, the New Jersey Supreme Court, took this up on appeal, and they affirmed the appellate division. And the court held that the harassment statute provided insufficient notice to the kinds of speech protected. And so therefore, there's not sufficient notice as to what is protected speech, and therefore gave law enforcement unreasonable discretion to prosecute permissive expressive activities. So, in other words, if they like you, they won't prosecute. If they don't, they will. And so the Supreme Court said, thus, to save it from constitutionally infirmity, the court constituted the statute as prohibiting only repeated, purely expressive communications directed at a person that would reasonably put him or her in fear of his or her safety or security, or would intolerably interfere with reasonable expectations of privacy. And then in a dissenting opinion, however, Justice Solomon agreed with the court's new standard, but argued that the defendant's conduct still violated that standard. So this is an important free speech case, and I think everybody should actually read that, especially if you're thinking of going out and doing something on the internet. So let me be back after talking or playing, hearing from a few of our sponsors, and then I'll wrap up at that time.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce. Building business, one business at a time.
sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Okay, we're back a few more minutes, and there's a case, published case, New Jersey Division of Child Protection and Permanency, that has been published, and this is an appellate division case, and it led me to think that people need to know what DCPMP must prove to remove a child, and I think that it's important. And it's also important to know how to react if, in fact, you're contacted by DCPMP. And the most important thing to do is cooperate. You don't have to disclose anything, but you have to cooperate. And remember, they really are doing their job. If they receive calls, even anonymous calls, in most situations, they must follow up. And so one of the things that they have to do is talk to the child or children. But in any event, you know, there can be emergency removals, and of course, they have to remove children from unsafe homes. So, but let me getting the court to approve a removal, what they have to do. So, as I said, it's the Division of Child Protection and Permanency, DCPMP, and most of us used to know it as DIFAS. It was DIFAS. That was the agency. But DCPMP is the agency that handles the removal of children from unsafe homes. So contrary to popular belief, DCPMP doesn't necessarily have to prove anything in court before removing a child from the home. And that's depending on the circumstances. But the agency does have the authority to make emergency removals. And these are called DOD, D-O-D-D removals. And they can do that without first obtaining a court order, but only under emergency circumstances. And typically, they really don't want to do that unless there's no choice. So typically, the agency must find that a child is in imminent risk of serious harm and that the risk cannot be alleviated or mitigated through services that DCPMP offers, or with a safety plan. Now, sometimes, for example, the workers can find someone else who can come in and supervise the children so that they're not at risk. But in any event, in the cases where they do not believe the risk can be mitigated through services or a safety plan, the caseworker decides that a child cannot stay in the home and be safe until changes are made. So circumstances that would warrant an emergency removal include a very young child being found alone, finding a child who has been seriously injured, or a child found in a hazardous home environment that cannot be quickly remedied. The other thing, and I'll talk a little bit more about this, when a parent is found intoxicated, for example, a child is in the car and either the father or the mother driving, arrested for a DUI, and in those cases, DCPMP will be called and may have to remove the child if they can't find the other parent, etc. In any event, once the agency makes an emergency removal, it must seek a court order approving the removal at a DOD hearing. And that has to be done within 2 days of removing the child. So the parent or whoever is in charge of the child is provided with a complaint when the child is removed, and the complaint has to have information about the proceedings that will follow. Then if a judge, what we call ratifies or approves the removal at the DOD hearing, then that, by the way, the DOD hearing is also called a Title IX. These are Title IX proceedings under the statute. In that case, DCPMP will proceed with placing the child with relatives or a resource family and working with the family on a case plan. If not, the agency must reunite the family. In other words, if the judge does not ratify it, then the agency must reunite the family, but may ask the family to adhere to a safety plan or accept certain services to address any problems or concerns. So given the short amount of time which both DCPMP and the parents have to prepare before the Title IX proceeding, the elements addressed and the evidence offered by the agency are limited. However, at the hearing, the agency, DCPMP, must demonstrate the child was at imminent risk of being harmed or injured if he or she remained in the home. So this is done, I don't want to say rarely, but it's really done only in exigent circumstances. But one of those circumstances can be someone who is pulled over and charged with a DUI, and there is a child or children in the car. DCPMP will be contacted by the police officers, and unless there can be a relative or someone contacted, obviously DCPMP has to take the children and remove the children until the other parent can be located or some other suitable relative can be located. Now, needless to say, anyone who is either under the influence of alcohol or drugs while driving with children is placing the children in imminent danger. I don't think anyone would question that. And in those circumstances, the judge will do exactly what's necessary, which is remove the children, or I should say DCPMP will remove the children, and then if they can't locate another parent, they would have to proceed with the DOD. So the case that I'm talking about is the defendant in this case appealed from an order determining that she had abused or neglected her son. She was contacted by the local police department to investigate a complaint filed by the child's biological father. The child, who resided with the defendant, allegedly called an aunt after he was left alone during the day in their hotel room. So apparently the child called an aunt, said he's left alone in the hotel room by his mother's. Now, police officers performed what they called a welfare check. This is another thing that happens if the police are called by someone and they're